If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain, where we lift the curtain on politics and theater. You know, two areas a lot of people think don't ever meet, but here they do. As the political analyst for WGN-TV and host of CLTV's Politics Tonight and Broadway in Chicago Backstage on the Comcast Network, we'll touch on everything from national, international, state, and local politics to the artistic side of our city. We're going to feature the hottest shows and theaters because when it comes to theater, New York, watch your back. Chicago gets it right. Plus, we'll look at other social and legal issues of interest to you each week, hoping to spark a little interest, ensure meaning towards the bigger picture, and maybe even spread some knowledge along the way. Get ready, everybody. We're going to raise the curtain. We're looking behind and underneath the scenes. Let's get to it. Well, you never thought this day would come, but the elections are over. It's behind us. Some of you happy with the results. Others of you perhaps still in shell shock. But, you know, the country seems to be shocked, whichever side of the equation you were on, at the results of the presidential election, just because I think very few people actually thought this might happen. So we need a little insight and as to how we might find ourselves where we are. Joining me is Professor Ben Epstein. He's a professor in the political science department at DePaul University in Chicago, a regular on my Politics Tonight show over on CLTV, and now joining the podcast. Ben, welcome, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did this happen?
That's a great question. I think that as you said, virtually everyone is stunned. I think that it would include even most people in the Trump campaign. And
I think it includes Donald Trump. I think he's stunned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, this is a political stunner like we have not seen in 100 years in this country, maybe even ever. I mean, in terms of an electoral stunner, this is truly historic. So how did this happen? I think that there are a lot of possibilities, but I think that one reality that seems clear is that there are real motivators, and I believe a lot of those are rooted in economic and cultural and some globalizing or globalization fears that motivated a lot of people to turn out and support a candidate, even if they had some qualms about that candidate. And they were able to, and Trump was able to tap into that much better than Hillary Clinton was. And it was so invisible to the most part that even the majority of polls missed it. That's part of, but just one part of why so many people are so stunned.
Well, so one of the things pollsters could respond by saying is actually we didn't get it wrong. We said she would win, and she did win the popular vote.
Mm-hmm.
This is the second time over a period of 16 years, the last time being Bush versus Gore. Of course, there Al Gore won the popular vote but didn't become president. So let me just visit for a moment on this concept of the Electoral College. And, of course, the history tells us that it got created back at the beginning because it was an answer to smaller states where candidates might not spend time, but also where you had slaves who couldn't vote. So it was a way of kind of evening the process. You're welcome to correct me if I said anything that's wrong. But my question is, has the electoral process seen its day and it's so tough to create a constitutional amendment? Could this election following the Bush versus Gore finally get some movement on this issue?
There will be action, and discussion has already started in terms of efforts to try to once again change the Electoral College. But I think that or maybe get rid of it altogether. I don't think that this will be a motivator more than 2000 was. I mean, 2000 was drawn out and had such a, you know, weeks and weeks of focus on that actual process. I think there will be and should be a real examination of whether the electoral process is, you know, the positives outweigh the negatives. But I think that one of the reasons why I don't think this is actually going to carry over is because Hillary Clinton and the Clinton campaign did exactly as they promised, which was to concede if the election was over and to go along with it. I think that if they were to press this and to drag this out and to really challenge it and talk about how the difference in popular vote and electoral votes, you know, how important that is and why that may or may not be unfair, that may lead to more of this. But I don't, that didn't happen. And I don't think this will be more than a relatively short and probably I don't see a major change happening. I guess is the short answer, but I could be wrong.
But because and plus they're so difficult, it's difficult to make a constitutional change,
right?
Something you said is so important because with all of the language and the accusations going in all directions, I mean I've never heard it worse in any previous election, and yet Hillary Clinton's gracious speech the morning after, President Obama's comments afterwards. I mean, all of this assures the peaceful transition of power. That may be one of the greatest things about this country.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And to be honest, it offers some hope, I believe, at least to me, in terms of a time that seems very very unstable and definitely unexpected. And so that idea of peaceful transition of power, of, as Obama said, sort of a president serving as a carrier in a relay, that, you know, carrying the baton for a while and then passing that baton off, and that ultimately, regardless of who they're passing it off to, their job is to try to push things forward. Mm-hmm. And both Clinton and Obama saying that they wish the very best for the incoming president, that they would like Donald Trump to be successful because he's going to be the president for everyone. Those are very gracious, as you said, and I hope that they will help lead to a relatively smooth transition. There's no question that this is a foundation shaker for so many people, and people's heads are spinning, and I've been in a sort of a fog trying to digest all of this. But I think that will help, and I think that. They both respect that process, that democracy and elections have results, and you abide by those.
I have this sense that Donald Trump winning the election isn't as powerful as Hillary Clinton having lost the election. And by that, I mean, while she was needing the support of African-Americans, of Hispanics, of young people, the problem was Trump actually performed at Mitt Romney-like levels, but Hillary Clinton did not perform at or exceed Barack Obama levels. So it really is about her not reaching the number of voters that she needed. So she may have won the popular vote overall, but when you look at the demographics of the group that she needed to have come out, they just didn't come out.
Right. I think that there were some expectations that certain levels of certain constituencies within the Democratic or the Clinton bloc, they thought they were going to turn out more. And there will be some second guessing, maybe a lot of second guessing. And the Democratic Party will need to think moving forward about how they're trying to reach out to different sorts of groups and to mobilize those that they think are relatively consistent in their coalition. But Donald Trump was able to tap into a lot of people that were motivated by a number of different things. And I think, as I mentioned on your show, I think he was a very successful demagogue, that he was able to use real fears that really do exist, economic fears, cultural fears, and really motivate those people to get out and vote in a way that very few expected.
I have this theory that Donald Trump doesn't believe half the stuff he says anyway, and that's not a negative to Trump supporters. I just think his history suggests that he knows how to play the audience, so to speak. However, even though he may not really choose to, you know, do half the stuff he says, we're going to, in the coming weeks, see who his appointments will be. And if you get people like Rudy Giuliani as attorney general, or just some of the very radical names that you hear about in leadership posts, and imagine who he appoints as secretary of state, it may not be about Donald Trump. In many ways, it was George Bush who didn't really have radical ideas, but he surrounded himself with people who just took him down a deep hole.
Yes. Donald Trump, one of my concerns of Donald Trump is not his ideology. It's not some of the things that he has said, but it's his lack of interest in actually learning about the political process. And it seems to me that he will be very, he also doesn't necessarily take advice very well. So I think that he will surround himself likely with people that he trusts.
And that's his kids. Yeah. What concerns me, and I'm being facetious, already there was discussion as he was visiting with the president at the White House that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, walking the grounds with one of the top advisors. I mean, are we about to find out that every Trump has a major position in the administration?
I would be surprised if at least most of the Trumps are not and are not actively involved. I think that. I haven't done a lot of research into this, but his inner circle of who he trusts starts with his family, and that matters to him. That's been consistent in terms of what he has talked about. A number of supporters that have been with him throughout, like Rudy Giuliani, and I think Newt Gingrich is likely, he's been talked about as a Secretary of State type position.
Yeah.
These are possibilities. The real question along with that is, one, as you said, how sort of radical or extreme are they? Two, how involved, how in the weeds will Donald Trump want to be in doing the research and learning about policymaking and making these decisions? And I think sort of along with that, what does he do when people disagree with him? He has not shown himself to be amenable to any criticism from anyone. And so if he does not change course, then it suggests that the people around him are most likely to be following his lead with, you know, and I think that's one of the things that makes a lot of people concerned is leadership style.
Yeah.
And ability to deal with criticism, which is a fundamental part of the office.
He's
going to be criticized every day.
And people who have advised him, who have made the comments that he not only doesn't have an understanding of international issues, for example, but isn't interested in learning. So my concern is, I mean, he also has been set up with a Republican Congress, both houses.
Yes.
So do we have a government where Donald Trump is going to continue to be a CEO as everybody does their thing? And what he's going to be doing is saying yes or no to what Paul Ryan wants in the House, what Mitch McConnell wants in the Senate. What his cabinet members want him to do, and basically have a president who's just kind of, I'm not going to say going along, but feeling as though he's approving the work that everybody else is doing. And and that is why these appointments are so important. And the positions of leadership power already in place in the Congress tell us the direction things will go.
Yeah, I think that's such a important and interesting way to look at it, because I think that you're fundamentally right that the Republican Party now has the opportunity, frankly, to get a lot of their agenda or move a lot of their agenda forward that they didn't expect to have this. They didn't expect to have this opportunity, and,
right.
and have largely been quiet on those fronts. If you take the sort of opportunistic vision for the Republican Party, it might motivate the different factions within the Republican Party to unify behind getting things done. And that would probably mean what you said, that they're going to help push things through and then have Donald Trump support those things or help him or try to convince him that they're, you know, in his best interest also. But I think that I'm overall very interested to see what happens to the Republican Party, because if the Republican Party, which has these different factions right now, if it essentially becomes the party of Trump or the party supporting Trump, or then I don't know what that means long term, because I don't think that Donald Trump is particularly Republican. He is a Republican in name, but not necessarily in his allegiance or in his policies. So I don't know what that means for the party. And if he is somehow rejected by some members like a Paul Ryan, then how do they sort of wage that internal civil war and identity crisis in the party? So a big part of that, I think, will be determined in these first few months as we try to figure out how the Republican Party tries to usher through their agenda.
And what we don't have here is an ability for Democrats to block. In other words, if he puts up, you know, we have his list of who may be Supreme Court appointments, and he's going to make one immediate one. And so mm-hmm. if you get somebody who is just way to the right, do the Democrats, they don't even have the power to really stop what he wants.
Right. The only real power they have in the short term is I believe it will be 48 members of the Senate. And so if you have over 40, the minority party can filibuster, or more likely threaten to filibuster, which is now an extraordinarily common practice. And that ability helps installing or stopping many forms of legislation, but it can only go so far in terms of, and there are some end-around loopholes that have been used by Democrats and Republicans to get around that in terms of things like appointments. I think that if Donald Trump, selects someone for the Supreme Court who is very conservative but is a respected legal mind, that they will likely be appointed. And I think that that's I think that that limited ability of the Democratic Party with a Republican unified government, that's going to be the reality moving forward. And in 2018, the midterm elections, which is the opportunity for Democrats to retake some positions, it's actually a geography that sort of favors Republicans in terms of houses, in terms of seats in the Senate that could flip or not. But that's obviously a discussion for future.
Right. So I imagine Democrats need to sit back and simply wait 2 years and hope that what generally tends to happen is Congress goes back the other way and presents a bit more of a check on a Republican president.
That's how it worked 8 years ago. The first 2 years of the Obama administration was included a unified, it was a majority House, a majority Democrat House, a majority Democratic Senate, and President Obama. And then there was an overwhelming Republican win in 2010. I believe that can be a goal of the Democratic Party in terms of a way to check, the agenda of the Republican Party, if that's the goal. There also needs to be real soul searching in terms of how to mobilize people who support the party but didn't really come out in numbers that they expected.
Right. We're going to keep tabs on this. This is just a beginning process as this transition, peaceful transition of power takes place. I think some of the country is in for a bumpy ride.
No doubt. Yeah, there's going to be a lot to watch over the next few months and couple of years.
Professor Ben Epstein of DePaul University, thanks for joining me here. And we'll see you both on TV and on the podcast again in the near future. I appreciate it, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. It was a pleasure.
All right. All right, having heard kind of a general perspective on the elections, look, the Democrats took kind of a shellacking, I think they would admit, overall, when you look at the national picture. So I wanted to give Democrats a chance to kind of speak back. Joining me, Marge Halperin, the Democratic analyst, actually, over at WGN-TV, a colleague of mine at WGN, has agreed to join me for a few minutes to give us her take. Marge, thanks for joining the podcast.
Sure, happy to do so.
So what do Democrats do now? Republican-controlled Congress, Republican president, what's your next step as a Democrat?
Well, I think a lot of the work is looking forward more than looking back, looking at how to better define the agenda that we have. We do see ourselves as a party for working people. Why so many took Trump's policies, word, I shouldn't say policy, because I don't think he put a lot of policy out there, is still something to be dissected in books to be written about. But looking forward, we do have an agenda for working people. We want to raise the minimum wage. We want to have job training so that those who are trained more in factory work in the coal mines and businesses that are not coming back
are
better prepared for the future.
But you can't now get it through the House or the Senate because there's no majorities there. You're not even a check to a Republican president. So, I mean, how do you accomplish that agenda, or do you just give it up for a couple of years?
Oh, I don't think we give it up. I think we continue to talk about it. We continue to work with our constituents. We continue to train and support up-and-coming political leaders and the leaders of the future, and we continue to build on that message. But we don't stay silent in the meantime. I think you saw thousands of people out in the streets last night who were angry about the result. I don't believe in fighting the result, but I do believe in fighting for our voice and our point of view and making sure that we're heard throughout the next 4 years. And starting right now, we still have a president. In fact, we still have a president who, through the powers of his office, has nominated a Supreme Court nominee that Congress has chosen to ignore. I think we should keep talking about that. We have a nominee, and he deserves a hearing. We continue to govern, Paul. And I think to end the presidency now is a mistake. Obama was elected, and he needs to continue to govern. And our congressional leaders need to continue to work for the issues that we believe in.
You know, when people are protesting, as you mentioned, I thought to myself, they're saying Trump's not our president and all these things. And I thought, did you vote? I mean, maybe in the cities they're all showing up. They did. But I mean, in some respects, do you have any regrets? Was Hillary Clinton the right message but the wrong person for this time, given what happened?
I think I think she was an excellent candidate, and I think she was prepared. She's experienced all the things that we said in the campaign. It wasn't just rhetoric. It's true. I think she would have made a wonderful president and a good leader for our country. Looking back at the messages and the different things that played, you know, there's some time to analyze that and think about it. Certainly, she was leading with a still small but more comfortable margin when Comey pulled his big surprise
right
in the final week.
Oh, books will be written by all that. I don't think there's any question. By the way, do you have more fears? I mean, I'm not even sure Donald Trump means half the stuff he says. But as these weeks go on and we start to see his appointments, his cabinet members, the potential of a Rudy Giuliani and a Newt Gingrich and a Chris Christie in various cabinet appointments, is that of concern to you?
Oh, it's a huge concern. He's surrounded by mirrors of himself, white male bullies who have governed that way with that arrogance that I don't think is good for our country. Look, we didn't vote for a President Gingrich. In fact, we had a chance to, and the voters repudiated him before he could even get through the primary process. So why is he in control and getting so much authority over Trump's decisions? That's unclear, and that's a question we should ask. And I think our party needs to continue to ask questions to help make Trump the best president that he can be. What are his conflicts of interest with his infinite businesses? And will they be in a blind trust the way every president before him has done?
Though not required by law, so it'll be interesting. So Democrats will want to be a check on a new president, and it's certainly going to take some healing time, though the president himself has certainly extended an olive branch. Marge Halperin, the political analyst for Democrats for WGN-TV. Thanks for a few moments now, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Sure. We'll be here keeping an eye on things.
All right. Thank you, Marge.
Thanks, Paul.
Well, you know, if you've been shook up by the political election, you might need a comfort dog in your life. Maybe we need them anyway in life. But so talking about animals, of course, another passion of mine in addition to the politics and the theater. And I came across a wonderful book called Heartfelt Connections, How Animals and People Help One Another. And if you're an animal lover as I am, this comes as no surprise to you. But I did find it surprising at just how far reaching not only the relationship is, but even the number of animals that come into play in this comfort kind of situation. All of this will make sense as you meet my next guest. Ann Beale, Dr. Ann Beale, is the author of Heartfelt Connections. She is also the CEO of Beale Research Incorporated, conducts market research for major Fortune 50 companies and all over the country and all over the world. And Ann, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as I read Heartfelt Connections, to be honest, when I saw the book, I thought, okay, I'm going to read about dogs and some cats and whatever. I just want to start by saying the world of, to use the term broadly, comfort animals, service animals, caring animals, goes well beyond it.
Well beyond it. Absolutely. I was actually surprised, too, when I started doing the research for this, that there are therapy llamas that actually go into homes for the aged that actually help autistic children, and that it actually goes even beyond cats and dogs to therapy pigs. And we saw, in fact, it's not just about comfort, it's about teaching children how to learn how to read, that we have dogs in the Chicago public schools who are helping kids on the south side of Chicago learn to read. There was no end of how animals help us in so many different ways, Paul.
Yeah, I totally want a llama.
I think you might need one. It turns out they're incredibly comforting.
Yeah. And of course, by the way, you did mention horses. Horses, another major animal involved in this. And ducks. Your sister has a duck. I mean, all sorts of things. Birds. I mean, there's maybe the better way to put it is, aside from, you know, maybe potentially dangerous animals like a lion, a tiger, or a bear, the point is, what is it about an animal that provides this essence of a meaningful relationship with humans?
You know, I think it has to do with the fact that animals read us at a certain level and understand us at a certain level that we sometimes don't always understand each other. And I think animals are very honest. They give very unconditional regard towards us. They are keyed into us in ways that I don't think we quite understand. And, you know, when I was doing the research for this book, I came across so many examples of animals that really were incredibly sensitive. And one of the examples that kind of floored me was one with a therapy dog that went into a hospital where there was a pediatric patient, a child who'd had some leg surgery and was actually unable to use his leg. And the dog stayed with the child for probably an hour. And, it was a very wonderful thing. And the next day, the dog was limping. You know, that somehow that animal was so incredibly sensitive to the child's situation. And I think animals do read us in a way that, you know, that we don't realize, that they do respond to us and are connected to us. And you know, it's not about verbal expressions. It's really about them sort of seeing us for who we are.
I think that dog was named Abby, right? I remember being
struck by
that story. Yeah, see, I've read the book, I promise. I remember that. Also, by the way, just for the sake of, you also write about cats. You've written about cats before in another book, but even the use of feral cats, and you talk about their importance, but even in relationships people can have with them, as you do with one, or with three.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I had become part of the Cats at Work program in Chicago, which actually places feral cats in neighborhoods that have a rat problem. And initially, I thought it was just an interesting program, but I actually learned so much about these creatures. And although they were very afraid of me, we developed a relationship, and they actually cleaned up my yard and the neighborhood of all the rats. But then they became an integral part of the community. And, you know, actually neighbors would come by and say, hey, thank you so much for what your cats are doing. But I eventually, you know, formed relationships with them that were very, very dear. And, actually one of them I eventually brought into my home. So, it's amazing. And these are wild animals, largely. Yeah. These are creatures that are afraid of us.
You also talk about, not every animal is suited to do this. When I say animals, let's just go back to dogs and cats and stuff. Like, I have two schnauzers, a schnauzer-schnauzer mix. I don't know that I would send them to a disaster site to provide comfort to people, because they're just so barky, even though they're lovely to me. What does it take in an animal to be one that can serve as, say, a comfort animal, support animal in that way?
You know, what I learned was that the people who are very good at this, they read their animals very closely, and they know which animals are suited for which types of situations. You know, some dogs are actually very well suited, for example, to be PTSD dogs, and they're really good at dealing with veterans, and you know, they can deal with that type of situation. That same dog may not be so good with kids. And what I saw with llamas, for example, and I spent the weekend actually on that llama farm where there were five certified llamas. You know, quite a few of the llamas just aren't suited for that type of work. And the person who, you know, really connects with their animals can tell, you know, what the specific animals are that can deal with it. And not only that, once they take them into that situation, they can read whether the animal's enjoying it. And so what I saw in these situations was that the caretaker would say, you know, I think that this animal's had enough for today. I can sense that she's sort of starting to get a little irritated. And it's that sensitivity from the human toward the animal that really makes this work so well.
Also, kids with autism, you talk about, speaking of llamas, you talk about llamas. And you had a story, remember, about a woman named Nikki. And they're amazing. Not only a lot of animals are amazing with autistic kids, but llamas being there to comfort as well.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing, actually, because I saw the llama go into the situation, and I was a little unsure whether the llama was actually enjoying it. And the kids were putting chalk on the llama, and they were, you know, putting barrettes on the llama's hair, and, you know, they go over and kiss the llama. And, you know, I thought it was cute, but I wasn't entirely sure if the llama was having a good time.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know I was a little bit stressed at the time, but what I found was that, you know, the llama was actually disinclined to leave, didn't want to leave the situation. And when we went out for a quick break, the llama was very quick to try and get back into that situation because she enjoyed it so much, which was amazing to me. And so, you know, there was something about this experience and something that my sister said to me, and she's in the book, and she had a duck that she brings to nursing homes. And a lot of these people who have dementia, they remember nothing, but they remember this duck's name, you know. So this is kind of this amazing thing. But she said, I said to her, I said, are you sure that the animals like to get out and do this kind of thing? And she said, certain animals do. This duck loves to get out to the nursing home, just loves it. This llama loves to be around autistic children. And so, you know, animals kind of vary, but they kind of, you know, tend towards certain activities and certain people that really work for them. And if a human being is very sensitive to that, it can be an incredible experience.
You told the story, too, of a woman who was diabetic and her cat kept waking her up and she didn't know. And finally, she went and just did a blood test. Turns out she was about to go into a diabetic coma, could have died, but for the cat saving her life by just sensing something and hitting her back until she woke up. It was amazing.
It is amazing, and I've heard numerous stories like that of dogs and cats saving owners' lives, that for some reason there's something that happens, and the pet knows that this human is at risk. And they, you know, in some cases, they one of the stories is about a woman who, you know, the cat actually scratched her quite a bit to wake her up. And basically they had determined that she probably would have died had that not happened. And in the emergency room, you know, they were amazed that she was still alive, and they said, what are all these scratches? And she realized that cat had been really trying hard to wake her up to the point where she was able to do it. But it was pretty amazing how much that animal had, you know, invested in trying to save that person's life.
So as you see the relationship, again, people, I mean, today, people like you, me, I'm sure people we both know where even our pets just become so much part of our lives, they're like our children. It's almost inexplicable when you read about animal abuse or people who don't care about animals. I mean, because the animals seem to be pretty much pure loyalty, pure joy, pure dedication.
Yeah, they are. I think that, you know, they are very unsullied in their approach to us, and they're very genuine, and they desire to, in some cases, help us, and they desire to have a connection with us. You know, and these are pretty turbulent times, you know. I mean, over the last couple of days, you know, I think people have been, you know, upset about what's happened or jubilant or whatever, but you know, animals, they feel all of this stuff. They could be a source of comfort for us, but they could also, you know, they can experience all of the highs and lows that we experience. And our connection with them is not insignificant. It's something that's been with us probably since, you know, the beginning of time, that animals have been a part of our lives. I think when we tune into them and when we're kind to them and connect with them in a genuine level, I think we're connecting with ourselves in a genuine level and with each other. And so, you know, they're part of our world and part of, I think, what makes our world great.
People might dislike me for this, but I just think people who don't like animals and don't like dogs and cats, I just think there's something not quite right with them.
I feel like that they're missing out on something enormous. I mean, it's interesting. People tell me that after they read my book that they want to go get a pet. And I say, you have no idea, you know, what this soul, what this being will bring to your life. And you know, as a pet owner, that you cannot imagine your life without an animal, you know, when you've had them, that they just bring something truly different and extraordinary to your life experience. And I feel that, you know, as I move through my life, you know, all the different animals that have been a part of it have added so much to it, you know, and taught me a great deal.
I think I'm going to be buying my producer, Kristen, of this podcast. She's so wonderful. I'm going to get her a llama for Christmas. And I think that
she would love that.
She's a really caring person. And I think she does all this work for me. And the least she can do is take care of a llama on top of it. The book is called Heartfelt Connections, How Animals and People Help One Another. And a good friend of mine and yours, Steve Dale, wrote the foreword for the book. Steve, of course, who very well-known, respected pet behaviorist and expert on animals. Steve is about 160 years old. You can let him know I said that. And but he knows his stuff. So I encourage people to check out Heartfelt Connections, obviously on Amazon, Anne, but if they want to get it, do you have a website they can get this from?
Yes, you can go to heartfeltconnectionsbook.com and look at there. It's probably easiest to actually buy it on Amazon.
Ah, okay.
But it's heartfeltconnectionsbook.com, and you can read a sample chapter and look at the table of contents there and whatnot. But Amazon's the easiest place to get it. And it's on Kindle. It's in paperback version, and so very
right.
Easy to access.
Read it with your dog or cat as well, or bird or any animal you have. Dr. Ann Beal, author of Heartfelt Connections. Thanks for being with me. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on the book. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.